Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 317.PS12605, certificate number 46512. The day the clown cried.
So, boy, starting the show off with a prolonged silence is really the only way I can do this topic justice.
It builds suspense.
It does. That's right.
It is hard to know how to react to the day the clown cried.
Even the idea of the day the clown cried, it's hard even to know how to react to the reaction to the day the clown cried. We grew up in an environment where a couple of things kind of exist now that didn't exist before. And one of them is the...
Almost everything exists now that didn't exist before.
Interesting.
When you look around.
No, some things existed before.
Everything that exists now did not exist before. That cushion, there's a time when it didn't exist.
I see what you're saying.
Unless some platonic ideal of that cushion has always existed.
That's what I'm talking about. I see. The platonic ideal of that cushion existed before.
Before they made it at Crate and Barrel.
But I mean, the platonic idea, even if you think of us as being things whose atoms are constantly shifting in and out, the platonic idea does not have atoms shifting in and out of it.
Sure. I mean, every cell in your body, most parts of your body... replace every cell in a matter of a decade or so.
But
you're not a different person.
The platonic idea in my head of me
your platonic idea
is constant.
Yeah, your platonic idea of you looks good in a beard though. So looks good without a beard.
That's right. The platonic idea of me looks amazing without a beard. One of the things that I've been meaning to talk about on the program for a long time, but it's hard to know exactly what the gateway into it is the idea of trash culture, which is...
What do you mean by
the
that?
The kind of Generation X, late boomer, beginning of an appreciation of not just B-movies, but of like...
Schlock.
Yeah, schlock.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, Joe Bob Briggs, So Bad It's Good kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a culture that's made as garbage, but with a hope that it can kind of exploit... an audience that has lower standards. And then there's the second appreciation of that material as So Bad It's Good, just exactly as you say.
Camp.
And it began as camp. And we saw it really rise in the kind of punk era of like the B-52s appropriating all the 50s iconography that...
Just like John Waters did.
Super corny stuff that was taken seriously at first, or at least had a kind of whimsy that was... That hadn't then been kind of doubled down upon by the punk rock's sort of hatred and reappropriation of older whimsy as a new kind of whimsy.
You only get it once, right? You only get one fresh, hey, like, what if we enjoyed this kind of bad thing in kind of a funny, ironic way?
Because
once that idea exists in the universe, a thing that was not there before, you can never be pure again. You know, anytime you appreciate something ironically, you're going to wonder, you know, are there downsides to this kind of insincerity? Is this any different than those other things? Was this being made on purpose for me to appreciate like this? And is that cynical?
That's the thing. The first person to find a pink flamingo in their grandmother's front yard and put it inside their flower pot in their downtown New York loft is one thing. But when you go to Archie McPhee's now and buy pink flamingos by the crate.
Once you give it a name like camp, it becomes an aesthetic. And you know, we're pattern matching computers and we've seen 10 campy things and now we can extrapolate all of it.
So there are in our culture, people that you and I probably both know, maybe me more than you, who lives in a more camp, you know, I've lived in a more camp universe probably than you have, although there's nothing more camp than Mormonism.
Mormonism does like musical theater. I feel like we could join hands with the gays just in our love for mid-century musical theater.
The Venn diagrams do overlap, but I've known so many people whose aesthetic was derived from what you could find in a thrift store.
You're wearing a Hawaiian shirt right now.
I am. I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt and seersucker pants, and I have what I thought was a non-ironic mustache, but the only way I can actually...
I'll be the judge of that, John.
I can only wear it out if I pretend that I'm being ironic. It's like, ha ha ha, I have a mustache and look like a creep. But when I shaved my beard, I really sincerely believed I was going to be handsome. But trash culture, because we live in a world of it, and that world overlapped real culture and sort of promulgated a version of real culture, now it's really hard to distinguish what's ironic and what's not. And I talk about that all the time, the kind of irony wars of the 90s.
It gives the artist an out, for sure.
Right.
Like, the artist can wait to see how the mustache is appreciated and then say, ah, yes, I agree with you, and the opposite thing, should that come up.
But almost all of the suburban parents that I know from my daughter's interactions in school all freely admit to watching television shows like Love Island and, you know, these shows where people they would not want to have anything to do with in life, they're super happy to pull up and watch them all trapped in a house together where they're trying to determine, like, who's going to be the winner, who's the bachelorette that's going to go off with the muscle guy.
I had somebody who would not tell me why they couldn't come to a thing on, I guess, Monday. And she was like, I can't tell you why, but I can't be there. It's a TV thing. I can't tell you what it is. And I had to think about it. And I was like, The Bachelor? And she looked at the floor, you know, but she genuinely, that's not hate watching or guilty. I mean, she genuinely enjoys it, but she feels like the culture has shamed her.
Well, sure. And I think the culture's right.
Those shows are not good.
But a lot of people begin to watch them, like so many things, with a kind of ironic tee-hee, like, oh, let's watch this terrible TV. And then they immediately get hooked on the cocaine of it.
It's well-designed, like cocaine. It's engineered to do what it does.
Right. But especially where comedy and comedians interact with the culture, there's that zone where comedians have to interact with something, right? Comedians can't just, I mean, unless you're Jeff Foxworthy, you can't make hay out of just what your neighbors are doing with their lawn tractors. You know, you've got to be commenting, because comedy, stand-up comedy especially, is a form of news broadcast in a way, right? They're They're digesting culture for us and finding what's funny or what's dark or what's dismal about it and kind of turning it around. But a lot of the appreciation of stand-up comedy is that it's introducing you to kind of a world of ideas that's critical or reflective of yeah, what's being
consumed.
It has to
be a reference to something you understand too, or you wouldn't be on board.
Right.
But once you do, they're gonna reframe it. They're gonna make you see it in a new way. And if it's done well, it will stick with you. Like, to this day, every time, I'm not some huge Jerry Seinfeld fan, but I think he has a joke about how, you know, is this a Seinfeld joke? If the aliens saw one species picking up the other species' poop, they would have the wrong idea of who was in charge. And I think that every time I bag my dog's poop, so once a day, I think about the Seinfeld joke that I heard once. And that's not the greatest joke in the world, but it really does show how, like, a clever reframing like that can really change how you see the world.
Absolutely. And comedians, at least of our generation, you know, I think the comedians of the boomers and the comedians that sort of laid the groundwork for the Seinfelds, the comedians of the 70s, they had mass culture to work with. You know, they had Moms and Dads and The Greatest Generation and World War II and conformism and all of this unexplored turf where you could make a whole comedy album about just what it's like to call the dentist and try and make an appointment.
It was a monoculture. You could assume that everyone in your audience had the exact same experiences. Right. And of course, a lot of that was done by just pretending huge swaths of America didn't exist. And, you know, and you're aiming it at a very particular white middle-class America. But also back then, there was more of a universal culture that persisted just because of the way the mass media had just kind of come of age.
Well, and comedy, stand-up comedy, was a kind of like an exclusive cultural venue. There weren't stand-up comics performing in colleges probably then, or you didn't have diversity of it because it was still an area relegated to San Francisco and New York. And
it was like eight guys on the Ed Sullivan Show, basically. And it was unusual when there was, you know, it took 20 years to get one woman doing it.
Yeah, right.
And then they treated her terribly. And then 10 more years to get a black guy doing it. And they treated everyone terribly.
Yeah, it was Mort Saul and four other guys that were doing stand-up for so long. But when stand-up became the new rock and roll, which was true in recent memory, at least in our lifetimes, not only in our lifetimes, but in our adult lives, or at least mine, right? There was not, I guess Steve Martin was the first stand-up comic to
fill stadiums.
Fill stadiums, yeah. Right.
But then there's also that era that came right after, that kind of late 80s, early 90s era of every stand-up comedian from mediocre to good just getting some seven-figure sitcom deal and becoming a cultural icon, the same way an Elvis or a Bob Dylan would have in earlier times. Now it's Tim Allen or Ellen DeGeneres or, you know, anybody who's mildly amusing on Johnny.
Sam Kinison.
Yeah.
Talk about mildly amusing.
Well, I like Sam Kinison, but, like, you know, it could just be kind of a pleasant persona would get somebody a pilot and a huge fat network paycheck.
No, I was thinking of the guy with the giant sideburns. What was his name?
Andrew Dice Clay. Oh, I don't like him.
Yeah, that was good stuff. Good top shelf American comedy.
Because, like, we've all heard nursery rhymes that don't have boning in them. But what if they did?
But a lot of comedy over the course of the last 20 or 30 years became self-referential, or it became culturally referential. It was not necessary that comedy be addressing a broad cultural truth or something, you know, out of middle America. You could have very niche comedy that was interested in trash culture, or interested in culture that was only accessible to people that were already in stand-up comedy.
That's the internet, you know. Twitter comedy is, a reference to a reference to a reference.
Right. Right. And subcultures,
though, you know, that could finally have their own sets of comedy where, you know, Red Fox can do jokes that you couldn't do on TV, that a wide audience wouldn't understand, that a network censor wouldn't let pass. But now his subculture can have their own voice.
Right. One of the great, I think, legendary tentpoles, one of the totems of 90s LA-based stand-up comedy. LA, New York, kind of that axis, the Upright Citizens Brigade, Largo, that comedy.
The alt-comedy scene.
Alt-comedy.
A reaction against all these club guys getting their seven-figure deals. What if comedy was a little more...
Renegade.
Renegade, nervous, yeah. Edgy, unpredictable, less formulaic.
Mr. Show, Bob Odenkirk, people that were on stage either being themselves or being every men and women.
Part of the laugh is you don't actually understand the construction of the joke or what might happen next. It's right. It's performance art as much as anything.
And one of the big, big sort of first kind of, what am I trying to say? An item around which, a totem, right? A golden calf around which alt comedy kind of not coalesced because it was going to happen anyway, but a thing that happened that sort of defined it in its mid-90s milieu, mm-hmm. its mid-90s identity, was the arrival on the scene of The Day the Clown Cried. And by arrival on the scene, I mean awareness.
Rediscovery.
And it started with an article in Spy Magazine that you and I both read in its moment. Spy Magazine being maybe a show we should do on the Omnibus because it was a short-lived but extremely influential Gen X sort of literary comedy magazine that explored
satire.
This satirical place where it wasn't clear where the joke was going to end, what it was based upon. Like the funny one, when they ran an obituary for Adam, the kid from Eight is Enough.
Adam Rich.
They ran an obituary for Adam Rich that was like a long sort of celebration of his life and his career.
I don't remember this issue.
And Adam Rich wasn't dead at all. And it was, it was pre-internet. So it sparked all these memories. You know, it sparked it even in the culture of people that would read Spy.
They had a very dark take. And they, no sacred cows, you know. Right. Like today it seems hacky to be like, you know, no sacred cows, you know, any target. It just seems like a Bill Maher thing to say. But back then it was kind of unusual to have somebody actually... What would they do? They sent tiny checks to a bunch of millionaires to see who would actually cash them. Right. Donald Trump actually did cash his
15-cent check.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, what was the joke of Adam Rich, the big sort of enshrinement of Adam Rich in the culture? Who was the victim of that joke? It wasn't Adam Rich because he was kind of in on it. It was a joke on you, the magazine reader. And so Spy was a lot of fun to read. You said you read that article in college?
I was in high school, I think, when that came out. And I actually wrote for my student paper in high school. I wrote a kind of attempt at a high school version of Spy, except, yeah. You know, turning the Spy House voice, the acid-dripping prose onto, you know, the bake sale or the high school play, you know, it turned out to be, I got called into the principal's office
because right, burning down those sacred cows.
The school did not appreciate, you know, that
private Christian school in Seoul.
I mean, I had not yet learned to punch up, I guess.
Well, no, I guess that's punching up. The bake sale, you know, ultimately supports the man. But this article in Spy was a kind of classic Vanity Fair or New Yorker style expose, except what they were exposing was a film made in the early 70s starring Jerry Lewis that had never been released.
And written and directed by Jerry Lewis, is that right?
No, it was directed by Jerry Lewis, but it was written by Joan O'Brien, who wrote it as a spec script. So it was pitched at the time to a variety of kind of, I don't know, maybe B-list actors of 1970, Milton Berle, Dick Van Dyke, even Bobby Darin, but sort of nobody bit because the script was a pretty dark take. This was at a time, 1970, where there had not really been any movies that depicted the Holocaust in the West. It was a...
Isn't that interesting?
1970. Like, I mean, there were some documentaries. There was The Diary of Anne Frank that came out in 59.
That's true.
A couple of films that dealt with Holocaust victims as they re-entered the culture, as they struggled with their memories.
But the trope of the serious award bait film that gets audience goodwill just by tackling the Holocaust, possibly self-importantly, you know, that's a post Schindler's List invention.
It did not exist at the time, or you could make a case that it was the miniseries The Holocaust, which came out in the late 70s, and it was one of those TV events where everybody sat down for a whole week and watched it every night, and it was
It's funny how those haven't aged well at all. There's still some memory of Roots, but you know, I'm sure 50 million people watched War and Remembrance,
sure,
and now like. I don't remember anything about the War in Remembrance.
It was the style of the time, but it was water cooler fodder, right? You'd show up at work and everybody would be talking about
some Sidney Sheldon adaptation that they watched part six of.
And maybe the last one was the Civil War by Ken Burns was the last time I remember, at least, everyone in the country watching a television program together night after night, where I at the time I was doing door to door fundraising for the National Environmental Law Center in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And I was, you know, they would drop me off in some neighborhood and I would spend all evening ringing doorbells and trying to get people to support the Clean Air Act.
And everybody was watching PBS?
Yeah, and people would open the door and they'd be like, what? And I'm like, oh, hey, I'm from the National. And they'd be like, are you crazy?
I don't know who's going to win Antietam.
We're watching the Civil War. And they would slam the door and I'd be like, because it was a perfect overlap of Venn diagram. Who do we want to support the Clean Air Act? Who is watching
some
public television?
Northern Virginia neighborhood where everybody's watching PBS.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I think, the last one of those. But Roots and The Holocaust were the first two I remember. But you're absolutely right that in 1970, the trope of the black and white or muted color depiction of people in a camp hadn't yet become a part of the culture. And I mean, you had Hogan's Heroes that depicted a camp of a kind.
A Stalag 17, but those are right. POW camps.
POWs.
There's barbed wire,
right.
But there's no gas chambers.
And the pitch for this film, it was not really a comedy. It was an extremely dark comedy. Ish, but not. It was not played for laughs. The pitch was that a clown, and I mean
a literal circus clown,
with a fake nose and grease paint makeup, who was part of a European circus, was bad at his job and gradually was sort of railroaded by the head clown out of the circus. He made some importune comments about the Nazis who were at that point occupying Paris.
Is he Jewish, our man?
No.
Oh.
But he was sent to a political camp as a protester, yeah. Somebody who'd said bad things
He's
about the Nazis. A subversive. And then once at the political camp, the camp was turned into a concentration camp. A trainload of Jews arrived, and the clown... the titular clown, this character, started to kind of try and perform for the residents of the camp. They rejected him because he was a bad clown and a sort of selfish, self-important guy. But he realized that even as he was being kicked by the grown-ups in the camp, that the little Jewish children on the other side of the barbed wire were laughing and loved his performance.
Oh, I see. The people who were turning on him are his fellow subversives.
Yeah, the other people in the camp that were there for political reasons.
Communists hate the circus.
Communists do, but we're talking about Nazis now.
No, but the communists are the ones. Oh, the guards are kicking him? I thought it was his fellow.
It was
political undesirables.
But they were Parisians, so most of them weren't.
They're just French resistance fighters.
Yeah, and just people that said bad things about the occupation in cafes too loud and were overheard. And again, this is at a time when representations of of World War II and Nazi concentration camps, they still had a lot of, well, camp, for lack of a better term. Like,
camp in the camps.
One of the ways that in the 60s people tried to understand World War II was, it was, they were just far enough away from it that they could make movies that were playful, you know, where the Nazis were goofballs instead of being sinister. And we didn't quite know what concentration camps were in the popular culture. They hadn't been depicted. How do you depict that? I mean, how do you talk about the Holocaust in a movie? These were things that hadn't quite ever been felt out.
I mean, I'm sure the kind of the residual anti-Semitism of the time, you know, brave liberals are aware of Anne Frank being a hit on Broadway, but it hasn't seeped down into, say, primary school curricula, right? Like, it's not part of our, like, today you can't grow up without understanding the tragedy of the Holocaust in America. And I think maybe in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot more possible.
It was absolutely possible. It's why learning about it, and I've talked about this on my show, Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast, where it's impossible for us now to think of a time when, 20 years after World War II, the end of World War II, the Holocaust would still be a not really popularly understood, even 30 years later. Hmm. And why would that be? I mean, certainly the nation of Israel had every reason to have, you know, popularized it in the
sure.
public understanding.
And there was no contemporary cover up. Like, the discovery of the camps and the atrocities there made the American papers.
It did.
And were part of anti-Nazi propaganda.
Part of Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. I think it was a combination of, you know, not just sort of pervasive anti-Semitism, but a thing that was unfathomable. And how do you go on?
It's a touchy topic, you know, certainly, because you know you're going to offend. You know, it's the same reason you didn't see interracial anything on TV until the 70s, because you know a segment of your audience is going to harum for be offended. And maybe you just, artists and media just turn away.
And partly I have to suspect that there was a tremendous complicity in the Holocaust, in the sense that the United States did not really act to help the Jews. There were quotas on their immigration throughout the war. Whole ships full of Jews trying to escape were refused entry into ports and turned back. The British mandate in Palestine didn't allow immigration. You know,
it's guilt as well.
Yeah, the Jews didn't have any friends, and it's very difficult, I think, for the United States in particular, who imagined that we were the ultimate victors of World War II, that we defeated the Nazis. Hard then also to say, and this is part of a cultural reassessment that we've been going through and are still going through, and going through in a big way right now, where over the decades, each successive generation is more and more prepared to describe the American story in less and less glowing terms.
You can leave tacit complicity out of a story very easily.
Yeah.
You have to actively examine it. You have to look for it. Autumn is here, John.
Autumn is here, and you know what autumn
season
makes...
Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness.
You know what it makes me think of?
What does it make you think of?
Well, it makes me think of new t-shirts of my favorite media properties.
The gift-giving season is going to begin fairly soon. Mm-hmm. And here at Omnibus, here in the bunker, we have not always done the best job at keeping a steady stream of Omnibus merch.
No, it's true.
Out in the universe.
It's true. Our futurelings are often... they often contact us. They're clamoring for Omnibus branded merch.
They're naked. They're shirtless.
Yep. Because fashions change and seasons change. Seasons change and so do we.
Seasons change.
And now it's fall and you want some new, I mean, a lot of futurelings are t-shirt wearers, let's be honest.
We are going to have a steady stream of t-shirt designs going forward. Starting this month.
What do you mean a stream? Do you mean like different t-shirt designs over time?
Yes, there's going to be new shirt designs every month. For October in our t-shirt store, we have brought back the two t-shirt designs that we had briefly available well over a year ago, whenever that was.
Right.
A time period so brief that many of you may not remember. Those shirt designs are now available again at mediocrity.com.
That's MediocrityE.
So mediocrity, but with a T-E-E, like t-shirts instead of T-Y.
.com/omnibus. And then every month we're going to have a new set of t-shirt designs. So collect them all.
So this month it's the Omnibus and Futurelink designs that longtime fans may remember from a year or two ago. The shirts are great. They print on next level shirts, which are soft, high quality. We've got women's size small through triple XL and men's size small through quadruple XL. This is our friend Dave Rutledge of Meh helping us out with shirt sales. He's the guy that owns my styrofoam head and made you tell stories that were better than my stories on the show.
He has bought your styrofoam head not once but twice on the open market.
What's the normal number of times to buy someone's styrofoam head?
I'd say two.
I think it's under one.
Really?
It's closer to zero than one.
Let's see. I'm thinking about all the styrofoam heads of famous people that I've purchased.
Do you have a list of those celebrities ready to go?
Most of them I've only bought at one time.
Who are some examples of those celebrities? I have Rue McClanahan at home.
I have Tony Millionaire. And let's see.
I have Dom DeLuise.
You do?
I like to get giant celebrity heads, styrofoam heads of celebrities with giant heads.
I have Jason Isbell.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a big head.
So if you are, missing Omnibus shirts in your wardrobe, if you're looking for Omnibus gift giving ideas for the upcoming holiday season.
That's right. Because if you order now, the shirts will be in your hot little hands or tentacles or antennae.
It's true. You must be a bipedal Omnibus listener with the normal number of four limbs, I'm afraid.
Not necessarily. If you have eight limbs, you can put two of them through the sleeves of this t-shirt.
And maybe drill your own holes if necessary.
Drill your own holes. That's the Omnibus motto.
Go check out the shirt designs at mediocrity.com/omnibus and look out for new designs every month.
So the script for The Day the Clown Cried was optioned by a producer by the name of Nat Voschberger, who wanted to make the film and had, you know, what he signed contracts promising that he would, that he'd pay Joan O'Brien $50,000 for the rights to produce her screenplay. And then he approached Jerry Lewis and said, Jerry Lewis, famous comedian, one of the absolute stars of that era of somewhere between stand-up and Johnny Carson guests.
Hard to express today how big a hit Lewis and Martin were at the height of their power. They had screaming fans outside hotels like Beatlemania.
And even after Dean Martin split from Jerry Lewis, he was, like a lot of those stand-up comics, on the surface of things, a beloved American entertainer. And then behind the scenes, you realize that they were all monsters, every one of them.
Not Ellen DeGeneres. Oh, wait. Yes,
Ellen. Yeah, even Ellen.
But yeah, Jerry Lewis was kind of became an auteur, directing and producing his own comedy films by themselves, which were huge box office hits.
And it became a big joke that he was beloved by the French cinématistes.
Oh, yeah.
The French at this time had made not just an art form out of film, but an art form out of criticism of film.
Yeah.
And the fact that Jerry Lewis was regarded as a great auteur and a hero of France became like a punchline. But
it was true.
It was true, right.
I don't know what they saw, but they loved it.
Or what they still see, because that's still true there in France.
It can't be true of the rising generation, can it?
I don't know. I mean, sure.
It's true that kids will grow up watching whatever old movies their parents watch every Christmas.
I do not subscribe to Cahiers de Cinéma, nor do I know.
My subscription ran out in 1968.
Do I know any of the editors? But I imagine there hasn't been, if there's been any reappraisal of the films of Jerry Lewis, I think they always come down with, you know, by adding an additional star. He's up to 7.5 stars now out of 5. Anyway, so Jerry Lewis was offered the role, and in reading the script, he thought, now, wait a minute, you know, this is an incredibly dramatic role.
It would be a first for him.
It would be a first for him, and also like a first for the world. No one had done a film about the Holocaust. And I should say that there were Eastern European films depicting the Holocaust, but within the Soviet sphere, there was definitely a take on the Holocaust.
What's the Soviet take?
The
Soviet take.
The Soviet take was that the Holocaust was just another component in the dialectic, in the eternal struggle between the capitalist West and the liberation of the socialist East. And so, you know, Jews and other concentration camp victims were just sort of depicted as shadowy and passive groups of people who marched passively to their death, whilst the, you know, the heroes of the films were all the kind of
Stalingrad, well, the defenders of,
yeah, the socialist liberators, and the bad guys were, it was less Nazism or even even anti-Semitism, but more just capitalism and the, you know, the rapacious nature of it. So,
and it's less of a one-off event, you know, a remarkable, tragic, never-to-be-repeated one-off event, and more of a, well, it's just what you'd expect from...
Yeah, this is what happens.
This is what happens to the poor.
You know, and in 1945, it was late-stage capitalism even then. but those were Eastern European films, and they didn't come to the West. They weren't part of what you would call mainstream film. But as Jerry Lewis... kind of was encouraged by Vashberger to not just star in this film, but helm it. He was given the opportunity to direct it as well. He eventually kind of found it irresistible, and later was criticized, as we'll see, as doing it as you suggest, kind of as Oscar bait or an attempt to make himself a dramatic actor. Jerry Lewis is Jewish, yes, and had plenty of motivation, altruistic motivation, to introduce this topic into cinema.
He could have seen this as important.
I think so.
I guess it's arguable whether he also is self-important about it, but...
Right, and as we'll see, that continues to be true about Holocaust movies even into now.
But the movie's kind of a tricky tightrope act, even if done perfectly, to try to make a black comedy about the Holocaust.
But, well, so what?
I mean, the title invokes something that's already kitschy, a crying clown, like those velvet paintings of the 60s. It seems like it should have set off warning bells even in, when did they make this movie?
1971.
71.
71, 72, they started to make the film.
So the crying clown was already kind of a eye-rolling trope.
But what happens in the film is, as Jerry Lewis realizes that he is funny to the kids and starts to perform, he's reviled by his campmates, but he starts to perform for the Jewish kids who are just behind barbed wire, have no hope in this camp, and all of a sudden here's this clown that's putting on a show for them, and he succeeds for the first time in his life as a clown, because he's never succeeded before. He's always been a bad clown. And now he's a great clown.
I guess he just has a more desperate audience.
Or they're kids, they're children. I mean, and maybe more desperate, but also...
If he's a clown, wouldn't children have come to his circus before?
I suppose...
Was he just performing for French adults?
I mean, he did have a job in the circus. I think he was bad by adult standards. But, you know, as you and I both know, kids have no standards.
He should have been a birthday clown. The day the birthday clown cried.
That's right. I mean, kid, if you just smear mud on your face, a kid will laugh for an hour.
Sure.
But the Nazis in the movie realize that he is a successful clown with these kids, and then they say to him, you need to come over and entertain these kids so that they will passively march toward the oven.
Like, literally, he needs to be the last show?
Their Pied Piper.
Oh, boy.
And they promise him that he will, you know, survive the war if he just performs this kind of... that he would, you know, he would effectively become a kind of capo, a Jew that was working on behalf of the Nazis to, you know, facilitate, to basically be within the Jewish community as a kind of cop or collaborator. And then the tragic end of the film is
what does he decide? It's not even clear to me what the right choice is there.
Well, so he entertains the children. He makes them sort of laugh as they walk into the ovens. But then he, can't bear it and holds hands with the children and walks into the ovens himself. Mm. Curtain. And Joan O'Brien, the writer, wrote it as a tragedy. It's very difficult to see how there's anything redemptive about it. Like, he doesn't go into the ovens and the world is changed in any way. It's just a kind of, he becomes, in his last moment, altruistic, I guess, or less of a selfish drunk. But Lewis, as the director and as a famous kind of slapstick comedian, can't help but start to impart some bit of
the rhythms of comedy on
this. Some bit of comedy, but this becomes sort of wrapped up in the criticism of the film that in some ways became, at least in our culture, bigger than the film itself. And there's the primary reason being that the film was never released.
Almost no one has ever seen it, right?
No one has ever seen it because the film wasn't finished. Lewis took over the production. The first thing he did was change the name of the lead character from Carl Schmidt, this kind of unlikable bastard clown, to Helmut Dork.
Dork?
D-O-O-R-K, Dork.
So he has a funny name, like a Groucho Marx or a Jerry Lewis character.
Yeah, and this is, this is kind of the first sign that, like, oh dear. Not having seen it, we can't really assess how badly Jerry Lewis misread the tone of the film. And the people who have seen excerpts of it, because the film was never finished, and as we'll see, no extant copy of all of the footage really exists in the world. Jerry Lewis did take an unfinished rough cut of the film away with him when he left the production. And the problem was that Nat Washberger did not have the money that he claimed to have. Mm. And they began production on the film, and Joan O'Brien wasn't paid. And in not having actually paid her, Washberger did not actually have the rights to produce the film. Jerry Lewis, once he was in it, he toured Auschwitz and Dachau, which this was before that was really a pilgrimage to make.
Yeah.
He lost 35 pounds on a diet of only grapefruit in order to prepare for the film.
Convincingly play a camp.
And then he invested $2 million of his own dollars to make the film because Washberger had none of the cash to do it. Then once the film was almost finished, Joan O'Brien had seen a cut of the film and said it was an abomination and she wouldn't allow, because nobody had the rights, she wouldn't allow this interpretation of her script to be made.
Well, there's one vote of somebody who thinks it's in bad taste.
That's right.
Even if we can't be sure, but the original author sure didn't think so.
And so the film, Lewis, takes this rough cut of it. Most of the footage is retained by the studio that bankrolled it, in addition to the $2 million that Jerry Lewis invested himself. And the film disappeared. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, it became a kind of legendary debacle, and it's a wonderful thumbnail joke. Jerry Lewis made a Holocaust movie about a clown that led the children into the ovens. Can you imagine a worse thing? And the movie took on a kind of legend as the worst movie ever made. No one had seen it, but it was the worst movie ever made. Until this spy article in 1992, when Harry Shearer, of Spinal Tap and
SNL and
the Simpsons fame. Also a kind of legendarily
he's a crabby guy.
Disliked guy in Hollywood. I mean, maybe not hated, but...
And a former child actor. Did you know that? He is like, you know, as long ago as, I don't know, the 40s, he's like Jack Benny's kid in things.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's got a lifetime of show business.
Well, Harry Shearer had seen the movie. Someone had a copy of it, and...
Oh, yeah, sorry. He's the Eddie Haskell prototype in the Leave It to Beaver pilot.
Oh, really?
That's how old Harry Shearer is. Sorry, so he somehow saw a part of it.
Somehow saw it in 1979, and in this kind of expose written in 92 about the movie, kind of, and it was, again, a legend, and so Spy was going to dig into it and see if they talked to everybody, what they could uncover about it. Just a great magazine article.
And nobody'd really heard of it, no. Like outside of show business.
No, it was just a thing like the Aristocrats, or it was a show business thing. Yeah. But Harry Shearer had seen it and gave lots and lots of raw meat quotes about it. That it was, he said primarily that there are a lot of things in Hollywood that you hear about that are described as the best or the worst thing you've never seen. And then when you see it, it's a letdown. But in this case, he said that seeing the film was better than the legend. It was an awe-inspiring film.
Not because the movie's good, because it's in as bad a taste as you can imagine.
It's so drastically wrong, he said. Its pathos and its comedy are so wildly misplaced that you could not, in your fantasy of what it might be like, improve on what it really is. And so in a magazine article, it became the holy grail of a certain kind of trash culture that... In 92, we were ripe for. We were, at this point, 92 was the absolute, you know, apotheosis.
We were so jaded by irony. You needed the jolt of actually Jerry Lewis dressed as a clown in a concentration camp to feel anything.
Because Jerry Lewis was already a figure of tremendous ironic fun for our generation that didn't live through his original.
We never saw the Beatlemania. The movies didn't age that well. We saw him on the telethons.
A certain kind of corniness. There's a lot of like racism, jokes about, you know, just every kind of 50s and 60s ableism and all the things that even by the 90s, although we hadn't given a name to it, it no longer went by uncommented upon.
And an easy to imitate voice, right? So you could kind of convey the surface level of his frenetic comedy without actually getting into its appeal at all.
Did you watch the telethons growing up?
I never did.
I did. It was the Jerry Lewis telethons on behalf of raising money for muscular dystrophy were, again, huge events in the culture. Everyone, like the Miss America pageant, everybody sat down and watched them. Because there were only three channels on TV.
What a dutiful country we were. You will watch these ladies in bathing suits do nothing for like 4 hours.
This is it. You know, I'm still astonished that people sit and watch the Oscars or the Emmys, and they're absolutely akin. The Miss America pageant and the Oscars were, I bet you they vied for one another in the ratings.
We were comparatively celebrity starved compared to today. Now, if you want to keep up with any celebrity, big or small, you have hundreds of avenues to do so. Back then it was, you know, you might only see them on The Tonight Show once a year, or they're guesting on Love Boat. You know, you had limited opportunities to see the people. Like, so what an event to see so many people in a star studded firmament.
There's Buddy Hackett right there. I mean, ready to make us laugh. So throughout the 90s, The Day the Clown Cried became a kind of fodder, and there were some scripts leaked. It became a kind of a thing that even to know about it marked you as an insider, because there was no way for the mass culture to be made aware of it. There weren't even clips. So it was just a joke within a joke within a joke.
And then what a white whale it becomes that nobody can see it.
Right.
Like that's a source of fascination too.
In particular, that the script existed. And so
because of the script,
you could do it. If you did a reading of the script in a Jerry Lewis voice, obviously the whole, like the tone of the film is going to be awful. And we don't see him acting it dramatically. So we don't know. We don't know what that looks like. Then another turning point was when Patton Oswalt, and this is in the late 90s, when Patton and people like Bob Odenkirk and David Cross and Paul F. Tompkins, these were underground comedians. They were known. I mean, only a handful of them had even had their first HBO stand-up. It was when HBO was still a thing that hadn't yet become a mainstream. It was still an edgy place for edgy comics. Patton Oswalt got a copy of the script and started to do live readings of it at Largo, which at the time was a little supper club in LA, a very dark and cramped little place where alt comedy happened. He got his friends together, some of the aforementioned names, and they just did a staged reading. I mean, they weren't really acting it out. They just all had scripts in their hands. Each had a role or several roles and acted out the film.
If I remember right, this isn't one of Patton's books. The lead was actually played by Toby Huss, who I do not think of as a alt con, 'cause, you know, he's just a beloved character actor. You might've seen him on Halt and Catch Fire or Carnivale, or what was he just on last year? He wasn't in Watchmen. I can't remember, but I guess he played the lead.
He did. And that's the wonderful thing about Largo and Los Angeles in general. Like, people mix and mingle, serious actors and comedians. If someone as beloved as Patton Oswalt asks you to be in his production, you know, there's a good as not chance that you can get, not just a serious actor or actress to join the production, but become friends and start doing shows together all the time. So they did this as an underground production, and they didn't charge. It was just a thing, word of mouth, like, hey, everybody come by the bar. Basically, we're going to read the script to The Day the Clown Cried.
Do you think the not charging and word of mouth is because they're aware of their limited legal footing to do this?
No, I think it less that it was just, that the Largo was a clubhouse and friends, it was a place that you did. I mean, it's hard to remember a time when this type of thing wouldn't seem worth money, but in 1997, I mean, I remember a time when the idea of charging $5 for a thing that you did required that thing be pretty good. And to even charge $5 for a bunch of people to get up and read a script out loud, it would have felt like, come on, who do you think you are?
Right.
But it became popular enough that they said, you know, I think it was the LA Weekly that said, hey, we're going to put this on our list of cool things this week. And they put it up online, or I'm sorry, they put it up in their, it came out in print. Patton Oswalt thought that that would be hilarious that it would be a thing that people would come to, and still didn't charge money for it. But on the afternoon of the show
that had been publicized unusually in the Weekly.
Yeah. That, you know, just had one little ad. The day of the show, Patton is standing out in front of Largo, and a guy walks up to him and throws a piece of paper at him and says, you've been served. There's an injunction now against you doing the show. And a guy shows up a little bit later, this kind of furious, red-in-the-face lawyer type, who says that he has acquired the rights, finally, actually secured the rights to make the film, remake the film.
He wants to remake a film that's an infamous failure.
This time they're going to do it, and they're going to do it right, and they're going to make it as a serious, like, drama. And he says that he has enlisted Chevy Chase to play the role.
Perfect.
Of,
Another universally beloved comedy figure.
And part of this is that by this point in time, 1997, Holocaust movies have come full circle. Now, post Schindler's List, as you say, the idea of the Holocaust as a way of, I mean, as kind of the ultimate dramatic vehicle, the ultimate
immediately imports a sense of immediately delivers a sense of importance to a script, right?
And I think there are a lot of people in Hollywood that were now the next generation who were not people that necessarily would have survived the Holocaust, but were their children, their generation of children, who felt like this was a story they were close enough to that they needed to tell, but far enough away from that they weren't just trying to block it out of their memories. And so the Holocaust became a topic. And Schindler's List came out in 1993, and as you remember, kind of swept the nation's attention.
Spielberg finally won that Oscar.
Spielberg, after all this time, it was nominated for 12 Academy Awards. It was the cause célèbre of that year. But in 1997, a film that was very close in idea, at least, to The Day the Clown Cried.
La Vita è Bella.
That's right. Life is Beautiful. Also won, and it was a foreign language film, but that won Best Actor.
Yeah, Roberto Benigni won Best Actor for
Roberto Benigni.
Jumping up on people's chairs, if you remember.
And he was a kind of, you know, frenetic personality, but that portrayed the Holocaust as a kind of almost feel good comedy.
If you don't remember the movie, if the memory of it has not existed to the far future, it is essentially the premise of The Day the Clown Cried. The guy's thrown into a, you know, we see this kind of friendly Jewish Pied Piper character, friend to all the children, kind of a shopkeeper, bookstore owner guy who gets thrown into a concentration camp and decides it's his mission to distract the children with laughter.
That's right.
In the camp. And he spends the rest of the movie putting on little slapstick acts in the camps to distract the kids from the fact that of the reality of what's going on. And it's a really uncomfortable mix of kind of mawkish sentimentality with goofy comedy that I don't really think works. But again, in 1997, everybody was gaga for it. You'll laugh, you'll cry.
At the time, there was a minority critical consensus that Life is Beautiful was terrible, misguided, and awkward and awful.
I mean, if it works emotionally for you, you're going to appreciate it even more, that this movie really threads the needle.
Right.
It's a Holocaust comedy that you're actually going to, you'll feel good about.
It was a massive hit, and Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars or whatever their rating system was. And there was some consensus that people that hated the movie and felt that it was mawkish were the ones that didn't get it. They were the ones that they were the culture police or the oversensitive left that couldn't understand that
they're scolding,
yeah,
you know, ivory tower, fake highbrows,
and that what the movie really was a profound interrogation of
man's
life and laughter,
man's inhumanity to man.
That's
and
right.
So forth.
And then not very long after that, 1999, only 2 years later, the Robin Williams vehicle.
I forgot about that.
And Robin Williams was also considered, before Chevy Chase got the role, considered as a potential lead for the remake of The Day the Clown Cried. Somehow that didn't turn out, but he then starred in the comedy drama film, which is a tough hyphen to take sometimes, Jacob the Liar, which is another like set in the ghetto and in a concentration camp where a man,
I totally forgot about that.
A man tries to lighten the burden on his fellows by giving them hope, by lying to them, and he gets caught in a series of lies. And he didn't, it wasn't intentional, but pretty soon, you know, he has to keep these lies going because everybody's counting on him.
The Holocaust is dramatically tricky because if you tell it straight, I mean, it's hard to see what the arc is. If you tell it straight, who are we rooting for? What triumph are we going to see? We know what happened in the Holocaust. There's no hope to be drawn from that.
It's one of the prime criticisms.
But if you show a successful exception, even as Spielberg does in Schindler's List, if you're showing people who escape the Holocaust for some reason, are you denying the enormity of it?
That's right. That's the primary criticism of Schindler's List, is that it tells the story of 6 million dead by fixing its attention on a bunch of people that survive.
And then you got that indefensible scene where they're led to the showers only to find it's actually the showers.
Yeah.
Like, it's building Hitchcockian suspense out of the Holocaust.
And that actually happens in the miniseries, The Holocaust, too. And at the time, to great effect, because you don't want your lead characters to die. You don't want all 6 million of your friends to die. And so Holocaust movies really... The only way you can have redemption in them is the Jewish War of Independence in 1948, which is also very problematic to the left. If they're, you know, depends on whether they're wearing a kaftia or not at the protest. But during this whole sort of Jacob the Liar era of Holocaust movie reassessment, all of a sudden, there's this kind of attempt to reevaluate The Day the Clown Cried. And Jerry Lewis is still alive at this point.
Right. He didn't die till 2017.
And throughout this whole period, Jerry Lewis is kind of extremely not defensive about the film. He comes out as maybe its most impassioned critic. Anytime it's brought up in an interview, he says, it's an awful movie. It's an embarrassment to me. It will never see the light of day. It was horribly misguided, et cetera, et cetera.
I feel like I heard rumors that he was guarding over it so carefully, so watchfully to make sure it wouldn't be seen, that it's the equivalent of having, you know, a briefcase handcuffed to him, you know, that he would never let anyone open.
If people wanted an interview with Jerry Lewis, and Jerry Lewis throughout this time also went through a long period where nobody was really paying attention to him, and then he was in The King of Comedy, which kind of actually did establish him briefly as a dramatic actor, a kind of lauded performance. It was a prequel to The Joker. And then, you know, toward the end of his life, he was given a last reassessment by comedians, and everybody kind of came out and gave him some props. But
if you live long enough.
Throughout that whole period, if you were going to do an interview with Jerry Lewis, his publicist would say, do not ask about The Day the Clown Cried. And aggressive reporters or people would kind of blindside him with questions about it. And he always answered the same, like, it's garbage. Don't ask me about it. It's an embarrassment. And in a way, it really contributed to the idea that it was the Citizen Kane of terrible movies. And he had this copy of it that he said he would never show. And when people would ask him about it, he would say, you're never going to see the movie, so get it out of your head. And these other copies that somehow people claimed to have seen the film, nobody knows like where these copies came from, nobody knows who they were, where they came from.
These underground viewing parties that some only Harry Shearer can go to.
And when I was really introduced to that culture, it was when I, through rock and roll, kind of got into that Largo group in the late 90s, early 2000s, and suddenly was exposed to this The Day the Clown Cried culture that still was, it really existed. All these, you know, comedians and other LA people wanted to talk about it. They loved it. All of them had seen little bits and bobs, you know, somebody showed them 3 minutes of footage, and the consensus that it was awful was so universal that it sucked all the air out of the room. There wasn't a version of The Day the Clown Cried in anybody's imagination that might have had any redeeming qualities whatsoever. Jerry Lewis died as recently as 2017. And upon his death, or shortly thereafter, his family gave the rough cut, the film that they had, to the Library of Congress, which I think greedily accepted it. They gave it to the Library of Congress before Jerry Lewis had died. If he died in 2017, then they gave it to the Library of Congress in 2015, with the caveat that it not be shown until 10 years later. So 2024.
Oh.
June of 2024.
We're not so far away.
I
need to be elected to Congress before then so I can go check it out.
The rough cut is there. And Library of Congress has no real capacity to release it as a feature film, to put it out on videotape. And they haven't been given permission by the Lewis family to do so. But it will be there and available for viewing if you go through the whole rigmarole of going to the Library of Congress and signing up and watching it there, probably on an oscilloscope.
Which I believe citizens can do. To take out materials, you need to be part of a congressional office. You need to be a staffer. But I think just to see materials there, I believe anybody in D.C. can get a reader card.
Yeah, and maybe Patton Oswalt will go do it. I don't think I will. And it's possible that once the film has come out and enough people have seen it that the mystery has dissipated somewhat, that maybe Jerry Lewis's estate will actually release it to the wider world.
Well, it seems likely that it cannot compete with this image of it. Like that even if it's a badly judged piece of art, that everyone's just going to say, oh, well, actually, it's no worse than Jacob the Liar, right? I mean, isn't that a possibility?
So in 2016, 31 minutes of it was released in a documentary about it in German called Der Clown. And Der Clown, featured interviews and a lot of material around it. And then these 31 excerpted minutes, which spent some time on YouTube. And I think the consensus about what was seen was very mixed and relied on your attitude about it going in. That if you were looking for it to be the worst thing you'd ever seen, it was kind of like Phantom Menace. If you went to see Phantom Menace and thought that seeing a new Star Wars movie was the greatest event in cinema history, it might have taken you two or three viewings to realize what an incredible abomination and insult to the intelligence is.
That is what happened to me. Like the mass hypnosis lasted through the first time I saw it. I was like, I want to believe.
That Trade Federation really does need, special exemptions from taxation.
And I had a friend who was immediately like, no, this is not good. It's not Star Warsy at all. And it wasn't until the second time I saw it that I realized he was right.
Roger.
The mass hypnosis had lasted for a full 2 hours.
Well, so around this time, Bruce Handy, who wrote the original article for Spy, interviewed the French director Jean-Michel Frodon, who had seen the film and was a revered figure in French cinema. And within the interview, Frodon sort of dispelled the idea, or tried to dispel the idea, that this film was a misfire. He said that, in his view, Jerry Lewis had successfully threaded the needle, and that if the film had come out in 1997 or 1992, that it would be sort of universally regarded as the first serious take about the Holocaust and an incredibly uncomfortable, but he said that's the point, it was the point, and it would be the point of trying to depict the Holocaust in these terms, in these like tragicomic terms. And
that's going to be tempting, though, if you're a critic, to have that kind of contrarian take.
It is tempting.
Especially if you're a French critic and it makes Jerry Lewis look good. You're the lone, the French are used to being the lone voice who can see the quality in this low culture figure.
But it introduces the idea that the notion of it being an abomination is also kind of culturally determined by how people thought about this kind of topic, this kind of comedic take. Jerry Lewis as a figure, a cultural figure of fun, and then right in this period of ridicule, and then the alt comedy culture of trash culture mockery, sort of that ironic superiority to things.
I can see it kind of playing the way Life is Beautiful does, where if you go in thinking what a heart tugging story this is about a light of hope in the darkest of places, you might be persuaded to think that. And if you're told only rubes think that, this is a monument to bad taste, you might think that as well, because the stakes are so high. And again, the Holocaust is just something we don't know how to think about just because of the scale of it.
Well, we have 4 more years to wait.
Everyone in the future has already seen The Day the Clown Cried.
It may be considered one of the great films of the 20th century.
Maybe everybody watches it on Thanksgiving, like The Wizard of Oz. Everybody gathers around in the future and enjoys The Day the Clown Cried. And that concludes The Day the Clown Cried, entry 317.PS12605, certificate number 46512, in the omnibus. Future links, we certainly hope that social media does not exist in your area, except as a method of delivering Jerry Lewis films to the descendants of the French, should they have any. In our day, you could find us at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, respectively, on Twitter, at Omnibus Project, jointly on Twitter and many other platforms. John was on Instagram as well, but don't hold that against him.
That was amazing there. That was really, I mean, I haven't been posting a lot lately because I shaved my beard and I have this silly-ass mustache. My daughter said, "You have all this chubbins on your chin." And I was like,
I didn't know she made up the word chubbins.
Chubbins.
She grabbed kind of the side of your lower cheek and showed how much of it she could produce.
She was like, "Look at this chubbins." And I was like, ugh.
I thought that was a cutesy word you guys made up, but no, it just occurred to her.
Oh, no, it's a cutesy word that we made up, but it shouldn't be applied to my face.
But there are photos of John's face in kind of its current Thailand sex tourist incarnation.
It's a pity, but if you're from the future, you can go all the way back to the summer of 2020.
This one entered the time capsule until October. And your beard will have grown back because you've got one of those beards.
Yeah, let's hope. Well, so this is coming out right around Halloween. So if you want to really get scared,
go look at early August photos.
My Instagram feed.
You can find fellow listeners to the Omnibus at the Futurelings groups on Facebook and Reddit. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us physical mail. This one here is quite a story because when Mindy ran by the post office to pick up the mail, this was one they said it was, this is insufficient postage. You're going to have to pay like $2 more to get this.
You had to buy this one out of prison, huh?
Well, Mindy immediately said, no, thank you. And they're like, what? And she's like, I don't want it. And they're like, but it's your mail. And she said, no, it's just unsolicited. My husband has a podcast and the one employee kind of looks at her. She waited in line for a long time because this is going to be hard to believe, but the president of the United States is trying to kill the post office right now. It's a
what?
Whole thing.
What? You're kidding me.
And
well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
So the single employee just could not understand why she didn't want this. So they're like, okay, we're going to have to stamp it and send it back. And she walks out to her car and the postal employee comes running after and says, no, I got it wrong. They had too much postage on it. So you can still have it. Come back in. So she gets back in line. And when she finally gets back to the front, the person checks and says, oh no, I was wrong all along. There is insufficient postage.
If there had been too much postage, would they have given her $2?
I don't think so.
So did she end up paying the $2 or did they just give it to her?
She said, well, fine, you can have it. But you know what? I've already stamped refused. And Mindy was like, well, I don't really know.
That's some post office inside baseball.
So what they did was they scratched out the refused stamp with a blue ballpoint pen. And we were able to get this note from Luna.
Looks like handwritten note.
It's a lovely handwritten note. She remembers you talking about wanting a trophy of your own, like my Jeopardy one. Mm-hmm. And so she sent you this in a pouch. I don't know what it is.
She sent me a pouch.
I haven't looked in the pouch.
I didn't say I wanted a pouch.
What's in the pouch?
Let's open it up here. The pouch says congratulations. Oh, it's a medal, a medal that that hangs from a, like a ribbon. It's like the medal that Chewbacca didn't get.
it says 2020.
It says 2020 on the lanyard, and then the medal.
Is that a county fair?
The medal actually.
Are you the biggest pig?
Is a medal, and it says best musician / podcaster / Alaskan, John Roderick. And I think.
Oh wow!
I think if you put that many conditions on it, I'm not the best musician. I'm not even sure I'm the best musician podcaster.
No, maybe it's or. You're the best at all in all those fields.
I have to be the
not
best.
Not just the intersection of it.
Oh, you don't think it's just intersection?
No, it's the union of all these things.
The best musician, podcaster.
And Alaskan. In all three of those fields, you're number one.
Here, here.
But only for four more months because it says 2020 on it.
Thank you so much for this. It's an incredible gift, and I will wear it now as part of my royal outfit that I put on every once in a while when I want respect around here.
She also sent us two silk masks for the podcast. She apologizes if they're not sea silk. But these are lovely. They're like kimonos.
Oh. Can I have the black one?
Sure.
You take the blue one?
Sure. Mine's blue and gold, like the Cub Scouts.
Oh, that is very silky.
And she also wants us to sign her mountain postcard, which we would be happy to do, Luna. Thank you so much for sending us all that.
Thank you, Luna.
We also have a series of more beautifully watercolored postcards from our friend Mark. One is a can of Libby's pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
I assume from
he's going back.
That's a Thanksgiving show from 2018 or something. And of course, a mail truck.
Oh, that's a beautiful rendition of a mail truck.
These are lovely.
I'm going to have to put all these in a frame. A giant, one of those giant frames that's made for like family photos.
And is this also from Mark? No, we have a second water. Oh, this is David Chelsea, our Portland cartoonist friend. I guess because we asked for watercolors, he obliged us with this beautiful envelope.
Oh, whoa.
Look at that.
Whoa.
Is that...
That's watercolored on that envelope?
It's Lily Pulitzer. Yeah, I thought it was pre-printed.
Whoa.
Isn't that beautiful?
It is beautiful. Is there something inside?
Yes, a lengthy note, which I haven't read. And then watercolors of me and three other people named Jennings, including...
Waylon Jennings.
Waylon Jennings, ABC newscaster Peter Jennings, and some kind of maybe Playboy centerfold named Claudia Jennings.
Hello, Claudia Jennings. She's the one I'm most interested in.
Yeah, no one's going to be looking at my weird shaped face
I'm going to next to Claudia. Google Claudia Jennings right now.
And also what appears to be a copy of kind of a stipple portrait of... I don't know, because I'm reading this in real time.
Well, if it's not me, I'm gonna wonder why I didn't make the cut here. For these arts.
It is definitely not you. Oh, Claudia Jennings is the Queen of the Bees, some kind of a schlock movie actress from the 70s who died in a car crash in 1979. Well, that's very sad.
No, that is sad.
No relation, I hope.
Well, she was also some sort of Playboy star because, of course, the first thing I did was Google Claudia Jennings NSFW. and there's
is that
just,
your secret?
Yeah, there's. I did that with Ken Jennings too.
I just put that at the end of every Google search, just in case.
NSFW.
You never know what you're going to get.
Who knows? You know, I turned safe search off and said spiders.
This is a stipple portrait of Meta Jardine, postal worker, which he did on an envelope for some kind of a mail art show. In
not M-A-L-E, Pasadena. But M-I-N-A-I-L.
No, literal envelope art, sending small-scale work through the postal system.
Oh, this is a whole thing.
I don't know who Meta Jardine is. He says she was a postal worker at the end of her life, but before that she was...
Is it M-E-T-A?
Yes.
I think that Claudia Jennings might have been in a roller derby movie called Unholy Rollers.
Have you seen it?
Roller Derby Apocalypse, where
mentioned she's in Gator Bait, The Great Texas Dynamite Chase, and Truck Stop Women.
Oh my God, The Great Texas Dynamite Chase has a very significant role in my young life. And
I don't want to know.
No, you don't. But it's amazing that
you became went from a boy to a man in that 48 minutes into.
I have a deep connection to the Great Texas Dynamite Chase. So well done.
Well, I think you deserve this portrait of Claudia.
Well, no, it's got a portrait of you next to it. That's not what I want.
Well, we can't divide it. We'll have to timeshare it. You get that 6 months out of the year.
Maybe I'll just cut it up with a pair of scissors.
Meta Jardine is an art school friend of David's, I see. She's got IMDb credits for her wardrobe and costuming work.
Look at that.
And she was a postal worker at the end of her life, so he thought she was appropriate. Thank you so much. This is lovely. We now have multiple people sending us lovely watercolors, and it kind of makes me feel bad.
Why does it make you feel bad?
Well, because
it makes me feel amazing.
Well, think of all the work that went into these. We'll at least put them on the Patreon, so potentially thousands of people can see them, and you could see them too. Not you, John. You can see them right now.
I'm looking at them.
But you, the listener, should you become a supporter of Omnibus on Patreon, could enjoy these watercolor postcards as well. You can do that and enjoy other fine perks at patreon.com/omnibusproject. What else did I do? The mail. Did I do the address? If you want to send us your own watercolors, and keep in mind, we have a very high standard right now. These are lovely. You can send them to PO Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, only 40 years since the Great Texas Dynamite Chase, we have no idea how long our civilization survived or whether it ever achieved those heights again. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.